Where would the regulation stop? No one knows for sure. What about people? In big city, people are breathing out carbon dioxide all day long.
The Senate debates Lisa Murkowski's proposal limiting the reach of the EPA. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 10th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, supporters of a controversial ballot measure are withdrawing from the campaign, but the opponents aren't going anywhere.
Obviously, the initiative is still going to appear on the August primary ballot, and the Alaskans need to understand what they'll be asked to vote on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation, and making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The U.S. Senate rejected today Senator Lisa Murkowski's bid to curb the Environmental Protection Agency's power. Her disapproval resolution sought to stop the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases. In a statement, President Obama commended the Senate for rejecting Murkowski's resolution. He said it would have increased America's dependence on oil by blocking efforts to cut the harmful pollution that contributes to climate change. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington on the Senate's vote.
Six Democrats crossed the aisle to support Senator Murkowski's resolution, but it wasn't enough for passage. It failed to advance on a vote of 47 to 53. One Democrat who is in her camp is Jay Rockefeller from the coal-rich state of West Virginia.
I believe we must send a strong and urgent message that the fate of our economy, our manufacturing industries, our workers, including our coal workers, should never be placed solely in the hands of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency.
Rockefeller has his own resolution that doesn't go as far as Murkowski's. It would suspend EPA action for 2 years. During Thursday's debate, some Republicans scoffed at science that says greenhouse gases are contributing to climate change. But Murkowski said that's not the issue. Rather, it's a matter of whether the federal branch or Congress should make the rules.
This is not a debate about the science, and science has been discussed a lot here. This is about how we respond to the science. We're not here to decide whether or not greenhouse gas emissions should be reduced. We're here to decide if we're going to allow them to be reduced under the strictures, under the structures of the Clean Air Act.
Wyoming Republican Senator Mike Enzi called the EPA's plan to regulate carbon dioxide a catastrophe and questioned how far it would go.
Where would the regulation stop? No one knows for sure. Cattle produce a lot of carbon dioxide and methane, so it's hard to imagine how the agricultural industry would not be impacted. What about people? In big city, people are breathing out carbon dioxide all day long. Could that be the subject of regulation under the Clean Air Act? Could breathing become a finable violation, or would there be a new tax as breathing isn't an option?
But many Democrats and environmentalists say Enzi's comments are completely off the mark because the EPA has a phased-in plan to regulate the greenhouse gases from stationary sources like factories and power plants. And Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse says now is not the time to loosen regulations on industry. He says it was the courts that told the EPA to step up to the plate.
This has been all the way to the Supreme Court, and it is established law that the Clean Air Act applies. So why are we debating this? We're debating this because the big polluters, the same industries that brought you the April 5th mine disaster in West Virginia, that brought you the explosion on the rig in the Gulf of Mexico, like things the way they are. They like the status quo.
Murkowski's call for Congress, not the EPA, to set greenhouse gas limits has been met with agreement on both sides of the aisle. Alaska's Democrat Mark Begich said in a statement that he agrees Congress should address the EPA's role, but as part of a larger energy and climate change bill. He kept a low profile during the debate and did not take the floor as many of his colleagues did. Begich voted against Murkowski's resolution. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry was also a no vote. He chided Republicans who are now calling for action but aren't moving forward on broader legislation.
This is going to be the great hypocrisy test resolution. We're going to see how many of these folks who are here on the floor saying we need to leave it to Congress, how many of them are actually going to show up and vote to do what we need to do in order to change things. How many of them are going to be on the front lines trying to, in fact, make the things happen that have to happen in order to restrain greenhouse gases?
Murkowski used a little employed tactic called a disapproval resolution, which she first floated in January. Thursday's vote brings her tactical battle to a close, but the senator's office says she remains adamant that the EPA should not regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The supporters of the ballot initiative that would limit access to the political process today withdrew from the heated campaign to win voters' approval in the August primary elections. Measure number one, however, will remain on the ballot. Opposition has formed as a coalition of organizations that includes municipalities, seniors, state employees, and schools. And Kathy Wasserman, executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, says the fight against the measure will continue.
We are not going to suspend our campaign. Obviously, the initiative is still going to appear on the August primary ballot, and the Alaskans need to understand what they'll be asked to vote on.
Ballot supporters did not return calls for the story, but the decision to stop campaigning for the measure was published on the sponsor's website in a message from Chairman Dick Randolph. He wrote the decision was prompted by a change in the ballot language ordered by the lieutenant governor with the advice of the attorney general. Randolph said those changes were made, quote, capriciously and unilaterally to give opponents an advantage. Wasserman says the ballot changes were not as substantial as Randolph describes.
It took out the word corruption because we didn't think that it really took away corruption at all. We were able to add immediate family members, that this law would affect immediate family of state employees. Other than that, it's not far from what it was before.
The initiative would prohibit anyone with an income of $500 or more at any level of government from taking part in any political campaign or lobbying activity, even speaking to a legislator. In his published statement, Randolph says the group will not attempt a legal challenge to the lieutenant governor's decision to amend the ballot language. This morning, the Anchorage police announced that the suspect in yesterday's officer shooting had committed suicide. In a press conference called at City Hall, the police released details of the investigation that brought the case to such a rapid conclusion. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
It was approximately 3:15 in the morning when Officer Jean Mills was shot twice when she stopped a car for an illegal right turn in Northeast Anchorage. At about 11:45 that night, the prime suspect in the case was surrounded by police outside a Spinard apartment building. Immediately after police told him to stop, Kenneth Alonzo Santori Robinson pulled out a handgun and shot himself in the head. He died at the scene.
I have no doubt that Robinson is the shooter of Officer Mills.
Police Chief Mark Mew based that conclusion upon an investigation that began offering clues and leads almost as soon as officers found the shooter's abandoned rental car behind Whaley Elementary School.
With the vehicle, you know, we could look at the plate. From the plate, we can find the owner. From the owner, we can find the people who are driving the vehicle. We can find those people. We did and started interviewing them. Those interviews, of course, lead to other participants, witnesses, people who have knowledge of the activities and whereabouts of the person driving the vehicle. All those interviews pointed to one person, that being Kenneth Robinson.
The interviews placed Robinson in the vehicle just before and after Officer Mills was shot. They also indicated he was alone in the car at the time of the shooting. Mews says other evidence supported the information gathered from the interviews.
Those lead either directly or indirectly back to Mr. Robinson as well. So that corroborates the witness's statements. And during the day, we built what we thought was a very strong case.
The police chief said by mid-afternoon, officers were not only gathering more evidence, they'd started tracking down Robinson. Robinson was rapidly moving from place to place, the police following tips and arriving at locations just after the suspect had left. At the same time, they were learning about Robinson's state of mind, both when he encountered Officer Mills and last night when he was confronted by the police outside the Spinard apartment house. Over the past few days, an agitated Robinson had repeatedly said to people he wasn't going back to jail.
We believe he's connected with some armed robberies, or at least one, in the last week. We know he was involved in a domestic violence event over the weekend. He brandished a handgun, punched out, or kicked out some walls. We suspect that he suspected that their warrant was coming out for his arrest, and that might explain his comments that he wasn't going back to jail, and might explain his behavior when stopped by Officer Mills.
Court records show several charges against Robinson over the years, some involving driving incidents, others robbery, assault, and firearms. The investigation and its conclusion took less than 24 hours. But while Chief Mew takes pride in the police work, there is also a regret.
It's a relief to have this case over. It's a relief to get it over fast. It's good to be able to tell the community the department's motivated and we can get going and wrap these things up quickly. It puts people back at ease. This isn't the way we like cases to resolve themselves, though. I would prefer it if he had allowed us to arrest him last night, and we would have gotten his side of the story, and we'd achieve justice in a different way.
Some tasks still remain. Mew says there's the autopsy and ballistic reports, along with the closing of the Sugar Shack robbery case and Robinson's domestic violence warrant. Plus, there's the decision concerning the legal fate of whoever came and took Robinson away from the abandoned car after the shooting. And, of course, the predicted lengthy recovery of Officer Gene Mills. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the art of preparing award-winning soapberries.
We look for the texture of the soapberries, the sweetness of it, how much water you add.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The U.S. Missile Defense Agency and contractor Boeing report a successful test launch. They say the interceptor test from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California on Sunday involved a two-stage missile. Missile Defense Agency spokesman Rick Lenner says the shorter-range missile was tested for possible future use, but there are no plans for deployment at the existing interceptor sites at Vandenberg and Alaska's Fort Greely.
The two-stage missile would give you a little bit more flexibility in terms of probably intermediate-range missiles or even ICBMs or intercontinental ballistic missiles at shorter ranges than the current three-stage missile that we use at Fort Greely and in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California.
There was no target involved in the test, which was carried out over an established test range between California and the Marshall Islands. Boeing spokeswoman Jessica Carlston says the test flight provided valuable information.
Improved data for our models and simulations, and as well as the entire GMD system, both the operational system that's currently deployed, as well as how the two-stage would operate in that system.
Meanwhile, full deployment of longer-range three-stage interceptors is possible by the end of the year. The plan calls for a total of 26 interceptors to be deployed at Fort Greely, the primary site for the long-range missile defense system. Governor Sean Parnell has posted a message to his Facebook page asking Alaskans for ideas on what to do with Sheldon Jackson College. Parnell's message was posted Wednesday morning. It comes just 2 days after the University of Dubuque announced it was abandoning talks to run a program at Sheldon Jackson. KCAW's Ed Ronco has details.
Parnell's Facebook page calls Sheldon Jackson's campus good land with great potential for Alaskans. He says the trustees of the college will be the ones making decisions about the future, but that in the wake of Dubuque's pullout, Alaskans should come up with ideas too. As of Wednesday afternoon, six people had responded to the governor's posting. One response suggested opening an inpatient treatment center for substance abuse on the campus. Another suggested establishing a center for the study of the U.S. and Alaskan interior to be named after former Governor Wally Hickel, who died last month.
We need all the help we can get.
That's Sheldon Jackson College Board of Trustees Chairwoman Shirley Holloway. She says staff members for both Parnell and Governor Sarah Palin before him were kept in the loop on what was going on with SJ. But Holloway says actually having Parnell helping to advance ideas on what to do with the campus is great news.
Oh, it's wonderful. I am so appreciative that the governor is interested and cares about what happens to Sheldon Jackson College. And he already demonstrated that by keeping the Stratton Library in his capital project budget.
The state capital budget called for $2.5 million to purchase Stratton Library. Parnell vetoed $500,000 from that amount, leaving $2 million intact. Selling the library is among the steps the college is taking to try and pay down its debt. One of Dubuque's conditions on operating at SJ was that it would not take on any of the college's debt. News that Dubuque was no longer interested in a deal with Sheldon Jackson came on Monday when University President Jeffrey Bullock sent a letter saying that the city of Sitka was unwilling to put forward political and financial muscle to make the deal happen, and that the SJ board did not share Dubuque's plan for the campus. The plan was outlined by Dubuque on March 9th. The SJ board sent a response back asking for some changes. So when Bullock released his letter on Monday walking away from the deal, Holloway says the tone and the letter itself took her by surprise.
You know, this was a real blow because we felt our response to Dubuque was continuing the dialogue. And for whatever reason, they decided that it ended the dialogue.
With Dubuque no longer interested, Holloway says the SJ board will meet next week by teleconference to discuss its next step. In the meantime, she's grateful for the ideas rounded up by Parnell or anyone else. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
The mayor of the Northwest Arctic Borough, Martha Sikorik Whiting, says budget cuts for the borough had to include funding for the public library in Kotzebue because she needed to carve $4 million out of their operating budget, and deep cuts were made across the board.
My intent was to introduce a balanced budget, and we're still in our budget that was passed is almost $1 million in deficit at this point.
But Mayor Whiting says she doesn't think the library is in peril.
The library is not going to be closed. It's going to stay open as far as I understand. There's no plan on closing the library as far as I know. And, you know, we're going to try to make sure that the funds remain there to stay open. And there's some funds that I can have at discretion to put some money in there. I have a $10,000 discretion fund to put in there. You know, if that needs to be, then we do it.
Whiting says budget woes began about 6 months ago when the payment in lieu of taxes or PILT agreement that the borough has with Tech Resources Limited, the operator of the Red Dog Mine, had a doubtful future. The main deposit at Red Dog is nearly depleted, and until permits came through earlier this year to continue operations there on an adjacent deposit, the borough did not know if their PILT money would continue. Whiting says Tech's PILT money comprises 60% of the borough's budget. She says borough officials are currently in negotiations with Tech to try to increase their PILT funds. She declined to specify how much of an increase the borough would like from Tech, but says they're looking at the needs in the borough and writing justifications to support the increase request.
We don't have that amount yet that we are working with Tech. We are, you know, we're talking, we're negotiating, we're meeting, and hopefully we will come to an agreement soon on what that amount will be.
Whiting acknowledged the importance of the library to the people of the region, saying a petition was presented at Tuesday's assembly meeting with more than 100 signatures requesting to keep the library open.
Even if that PILT does not get done ASAP, you know, the library is a critical part of operations, so definitely we would work on keeping the library open.
Whiting says when the PILT funds are available, program cuts made in the approved budget will be reversed.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Anglers who hope to get a piece of the king salmon action on the Anchor River this weekend were dealt a blow today. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced that the river will be restricted to catch and release only as of midnight Friday. Fish and Game biologist Nick Sarzi says the king salmon count coming from the weir at Anchor River is lagging behind the count in 2008.
That's a year where we had, looks like, similar run timing, and we just barely made our escapement goal. So we're hopeful that the counts will continue to be in the vicinity of where they have been the past few days, around 200 fish a day.
According to the emergency order beginning at 12:01 a.m. Saturday, Anchor River fishermen cannot possess, retain, or remove from the water any king salmon. Nikki Sarzi says Fish and Game stopped short of an outright closure on the Anchor River.
We didn't close it because we are hopeful that we will make the goal, and we are just waiting for more days of count to give us an idea of how close we're going to be to the goal.
Sarzi expects the restrictions on the Anchor and Kosilof rivers, added to the closure of the Kenai River, to put pressure on Deep Creek and the Nanilchik River. Sarzi says Fish and Game does not monitor the Nanilchik River in season.
So we just have had fishing reports of it being, you know, kind of variable from slow to okay, depending on when people were fishing and who you talk to. But the past 3 years, we've had relatively low escapements to the Nanilchik, and we didn't make our goal last year or in 2007. So we're being very cautious.
Sarzi says that while there is no deadline to meet the escapement goal on the Anchor River, it is possible the restrictions could be lifted before the end of the king season. Soapberries are a traditional food for many Tlingit in northern Southeast, British Columbia, and the Yukon Territory. They're collected and sometimes preserved, then whipped up into a frothy treat with a taste a little like ice cream. The small red berries were prepared and taste tested during a contest that was part of the recent Celebration 2010 events in Juneau. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld prepared this report.
Where did you get your soapberries?
Things.
Oh, you're from Haines.
I'm Haines Kokwan.
Oh.
Uncle Katie.
Oh.
You?
In a room busy with reminiscing villagers and curious newcomers, the four contestants prepare for the competition. They unload jars of the preserved small red berries, plus sugar, containers of fruit juice, and the bowls they'll mix them in.
My name's Doris McLean. I'm from the Yukon, Whitehorse. I'm just beading it with sugar and water and smashing it up and putting a little other, like, you know, juices in there.
Fran Newman. I'm from Carcrest, Yukon. I pick them in the late summer, early fall, and boil it for a few minutes with some sugar and water, and then I jar them.
Helen Abbott Watkins. I'm from Haines, Clockwan area. I have a combination of the ripe soapberry and the green soapberry, so I'm going to combine them together because this one has a sour taste, the red, and the green is really mellow, but it whips a whole lot stiffer.
Louise Marie Gordon from Athlin, B.C., today I started out at a very low speed and then sped the beater up as I went along, and then added the sugar. But I think I added just a little too much sugar. You have to have just the right amount of sugar so the soapberries could keep its texture. If you add too much, it gets watery really fast and it's not really creamy like ice cream.
For many, soap berries are part of a lifelong tradition. How they're gathered, flavored, and made has been handed down from generation to generation.
This has always been something that we did as a family. We'd go out on berry camp, picking berries for the, you know, in the fall time.
When I was a little girl, I used to go picking with my mom and dad, and my sister and I would take a little tiny bag of sugar in our pocket, and we'd grab a handful, and we'd rub it in the palms of our hands, and sprinkle sugar on it, rub it again, and then lick it off our heads.
My grandchild and I picked the berries, and then we cleaned it up and just boiled it on the stove, and then we just canned it. And she had her special jars, and I had my special jars. This is one of our hours together.
In the old days, berries were gathered in hand-woven baskets. They were whipped into a foamy treat with a stick, or more recently, a hand-cranked egg beater. Now, people use electric mixers. As the contestants finish their mixing, they hand out samples in paper cups. Some are taken to a trio of judges in another room where they're taste tested.
My name is Emma Joanne Shorty. My Tlingit name is Lasai. I live in Teslin.
What do you look for when you're judging soap berries?
We look for the texture of the soap berries, the sweetness of it, how much water you add. And the texture of it is very important because it tastes really good then.
Marcia Hotch.
And where are you from?
I'm from Klukwan.
How did what you tasted today compare to what you're used to back home?
It was really good. You know, they did very well.
Tell me your name.
It's Pam Bogda.
And where are you from?
I'm from Huna.
And tell me what you thought of the soap berries today.
It's always a treat to come here and participate with the soap berries. I grew up in Huna with my grandma preparing it all the time when we were young. So it just brings back fond memories of being at home.
This year's winner was Doris McLean of Whitehorse. Fran Newman of Carcross took second, and Louise Gordon of Atlin placed third. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.